I want to talk about your early days as a musician and the transitions you made in your life.
How much time do we have?
Well, we can go on forever, just like Shostakovich. You know, there's 15 symphonies, yeah, right?
That's right.
The early days, the beginnings of it.
Well, I started in my public school program, which I'm forever indebted to this day. That's why I think education is so important to me. I've been involved in education of every orchestra I've ever played with, because it's been such an integral part of how I started. So I started in fourth grade and wanted to play the oboe, because my sisters played the oboe. And where I was growing up in this tiny town in western Pennsylvania, the reeds were too expensive. And they didn't have instruments, you know, to give us. So I said, oh, well, the next best thing is the flute. And I was bad. I was really, really bad. So bad that the band directors tried to convince my parents that I should quit and continue piano. Because I was a pianist. I played piano from the time I was three.
Where was this? Where did you grow up?
Somerset, Pennsylvania.
Somerset, Pennsylvania.
It's a little town, western Pennsylvania, about an hour east of Pittsburgh.
Wow.
An hour and a half east of Pittsburgh.
That's steel coal mining country?
Coal mining. If you ever drive through Pennsylvania on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, you drive straight through the middle of downtown Somerset. For many years, it was its only claim to fame, that the Pennsylvania Turnpike goes right through the middle of town. It's the only town on the Pennsylvania Turnpike.
Yeah, I think Henry Mancini is from Aliquippa.
He is from Aliquippa.
And my wife said there's a big Italian community out there too, in Tacani, I think.
Oh, okay.
Tacani, out that way.
Yeah.
They're from there's an Italian community out in there. They work the coal mines and the steel mills and things like that.
Okay. Lauren Mazel was from Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. So that was the big musical family in my, you know, when growing up, we all knew who the Mazels were. We knew, you know, when I was a kid.
So,
but I grew up watching Previn in the Pittsburgh on the local public radio station and TV. So that was, every time I hear that movement of Carmina Burana, I think about that, Previn in the Pittsburgh. It was their theme song, the orchestral movement. Anyway, so I played in the fourth grade and went through middle school and high school and started studying with the principal flutist of the Pittsburgh Symphony my junior year of high school. I had studied with my band director's wife for many years, and they decided I needed something better. And it was a shocking transition. He was very difficult, basically told me that I shouldn't play the flute and I should quit. So I ended up trying to audition for Duquesne and was accepted as a music education major, and which I did not want to do. And so my father said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to play. I just need a teacher to explain it, how to do it. And so I went down the street to Carnegie Mellon, and they accepted me. So I started there and then studied with various people. Ethan Stang was there for the first couple of years I was there. He was the piccolo player in the Pittsburgh Symphony. And he was a wonderful man, very much a grandfather figure, and helped me kind of heal from the wounds of my high school teacher. And but then I took lessons with, traveled to Minnesota to take lessons with the principal flutist of the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, whose name is Julia Bogorad. And we spent 2.5 hours doing nothing but long tones. And when I say long tones, I mean holding a B for a long time before she'd let me move on to a B flat till I got the exact right sound. And she explained to me exactly what needed to happen, how I needed to move my air, how I needed to use my face. And then from that point, I called Jeff Kaner, who was principal flute in the Cleveland Orchestra, and asked if I could come take a lesson. And he said, well, you know, I'm expensive. And it was $50 an hour, which in 1984 was
a lot of bread.
A lot of money for my family. My father is a Lutheran minister, was a Lutheran minister. So they didn't make a lot of money. And but they drove me up there and, you know, made sure I had the right instrument and, you know, did whatever they had to do to make sure I could get to where I needed to be. And I went and played for him, and he had heard me in college, and he asked me, he said, well, what did you do between now and the last time I heard you? I said, I took a couple lessons with Julia Bogorad in St. Paul. And he said, well, that was a good move, because you figured out what you needed to do, what you needed to fix. And so I started studying with him, and studied with him all through, I went to CIM for grad school, and worked with him all through that time, and played with great conductors, and, you know, just had a great, great time.
What was the real turning point, the major breakthrough in your career at that time?
Well, I was playing the flute all the time. The major turning point was when I discovered the piccolo. Mm-hmm. And that was a concert at Cleveland Orchestra. And I distinctly remember to this day what they were playing. I was sitting in the last row of Severance Hall, which was the best place to hear. And it was where the students' tickets were. So I was sitting back there. And it was Yo-Yo playing Shostakovich. And first piece in the program was Mother Goose, Ravel Mother Goose. And the last piece in the program was Daphnis. And, of course, you know, my teacher, Jeff Kaner, sounded like a million bucks, and I was ready for him to sound like a million bucks. But what really caught me was through each of those performances was this incredible piccolo playing that I just couldn't keep my ears off of. I mean, it was just stunning. It was stunning. And I ran backstage, and I found my teacher, and I said, "Can you find Mr. Hebert?" And he's like, "He always leaves. He's the first person out." And so I called him later on and I said, "I'd like to take a lesson. I want to know how to do that." And I remember going in for my very first lesson and he asked me, he said, "You know, what's your motivation?" I said, "Well, there's a piccolo audition coming up." He said, "Well, do you want to play the piccolo?" I said, "I don't know. I think I probably could. I had a crappy instrument." And all silver, 1923 Haynes piccolo, all silver piccolo. I said, "Well, you probably need to get something a little better." And so I did. I found a used instrument, which was a beautiful instrument, and went in and took a lesson. And he said, "No, come back. Absolutely come back." And I was hooked. From the first lesson I took with him through all the time. The last lesson I took with him was 10 years ago before I took the Boston Symphony audition. And he's now 93. They just honored him at the Flute Convention in San Diego. He is an amazing person, an amazing teacher.
And
so
here
that's
you are.
What got me hooked.
Here you are now, you know, in one of the most exciting eras in this orchestra's history.
It
playing
certainly is.
A repertoire.
It certainly is.
That you must have thought about, you dreamed about playing. Shostakovich, 15 symphonies?
All of them, yeah.
Piccolo is...
I was hoping I'd be doing it in my mid-20s to early 30s rather than in my mid-50s, but it's okay. I'm thrilled to do it whenever I get to do it. And with Andres, it's a whole nother experience. I mean, he knows that repertoire so well, and it's so much fun to play for him. So, of course, there's for me, especially in the symphonies we just recorded and the two that are coming up, in 6 and 7 that we're recording this year, it's some of the scariest piccolo repertoire that comes out.
What makes it scary?
Well, it's very exposed, and it covers everything from extraordinarily soft, sustained playing all by myself to riding the top of the orchestra and coloring the violins and forte, high register, lots of, you know, high technical passages. So it's very technically difficult, but it's very musically difficult. So it doesn't ever let down, except for the fact when, for instance, in Shostakovich 10, I sit for a good 7 minutes before I play that last solo in the first movement. So I have 7 minutes to get all worked up and scared and contemplate that first entrance.
And you did something right, because that's a Grammy Award winning
recording.
It's
a great, I'm very proud of that recording, I have to say. I'm very proud of that recording. But it was very, 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 very stressful. So, you know, that the stress of the music and the stress of the recording itself is bad. But having to do it with somebody like Andres is a joy, because it's for him, it's really about what we're trying to bring to the music, what we want to say. And you realize, you know, your purpose is much higher than, "Oh, geez, that B flat was really out of tune." I mean, that's easy to fix. You know, those things you can fix. But when you're playing for somebody who has such a love of the score and the music and the history, the time period of history, it's incredible. It's really incredible. So it's an amazing time for the orchestra. I have to say, to a person, you know, you look around and people are happy. They're smiling. They're excited to play. The audience is excited. You know, it's great.
Andres talks a lot about, as a youngster, growing up under Stalin's shadow. What a
mm-hmm.
great title that is for look at this retrospective that he's bringing back Shostakovich into the mainstream.
Right.
There are times in the music when we're doing our radio broadcasts, and I know I speak for Brian and our crew, that we're listening in the headsets, and I hear this melancholy, poignancy, suffering, and then all of a sudden, the satire, the biting satire. It's like he's nailing it to the regime all the time.
All the time.
And you must, as a player, you're going through all those transitions.
Right. Exactly. And you have to bring that sense so the audience really hears it. You know, it's incredible music because he wrote pieces where he needed Stalin to think he was praising him and praising all the work he was doing. And at the same time, you know darn well, there was none of that in the music. So, you know, to bring out that bite underneath all these amazing triumphal chords, and you realize it was ugliness. It was ugliness at that time. It's hard to do. And I think Andres really understands the extremes of that music really, really well.
The Leningrad is coming up.
I know, and I've never played it. I've never played that, and I've never played Six. I've studied them, but I've never played them. So I'm really excited to do that. The Leningrad, there's a couple of really interesting books. One is a children's book, a young adult book, that I just bought for my kids that I'm actually going to read before I
Speaking of your children, they're musicians.
My kids are musicians, and my husband's a musician, so we're all...
One big happy family.
Although they're all bass clef musicians. My husband's a cellist, and he plays oftentimes with the Esplanade Orchestra, but he plays Pro Arte Chamber Orchestra and Rhode Island Philharmonic, and does a lot of freelancing and teaching in the area. And my oldest picked the cello, and he's been playing since he was 4. And my youngest wanted to play the bass from the time he was little, and my argument was, you're too small. There isn't a bass. You can't do that. So he played the cello for a little while because he was certainly not going to play a treble clef instrument. Until in first grade, we were in Houston, Texas. They needed violins in their orchestra. They had an orchestra in the public school in the first grade. And so he decided he wanted to be a violinist. And that lasted all of about a year and a half, maybe. And he said he didn't like the sound. I think it's all the years of hearing me practice in the back room where they would come in and beg me to stop. Mama, please stop. Please stop. So when we moved here to Boston, I was talking to one of my colleagues, Todd Sieber, in the orchestra, and I said, Christopher really wants to play the bass, but he's only in second grade. I don't think there's a bass, you know, the instrument's too big. And Todd said, oh, no, there are basses. You can get him a bass. So soon as he could do it. So he's a bass player. He was at BUTI this summer.
I want to ask you about your instruments because... we talk about the violin, everybody says a Stradivarius. Is there a Stradivarius or piccolos?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Wind players don't usually play older instruments because the scale is so different and the technology is so different. So it's not like you would find a flute that's playable in a modern orchestra that was made in the 1700s like you find with cellos and violins and violas. But I do play what I consider to be the Stradivarius of piccolos because of its history and just because of the sound of the instrument. It was made in 1937 by Vern Q. Powell, who was a Boston flute maker. And then the shop was right across the street from Symphony Hall on Huntington Avenue, where the From the Top offices are, and Music Espresso, and NEC has offices in that building. And the Powell flute maker used to be there, and up until 1937, they had always made, they had made silver piccolos up until then, and then they realized that silver was used with flutes because of the ability to be able to project. Silver flutes in those days tended to project clearer and better through the larger orchestras than wood did. Piccolos don't ever have trouble being heard. So they went back to making piccolos out of wood, but just the bodies. And the head joints were made out of silver to look like a little flute. So it had an embouchure plate and all of that. And then Powell in 37 decided he was going to make an all-wood piccolo. And he made it for George Madsen, who was the piccolo player in the Boston Symphony. And George had that piccolo. And we think, I don't have proof, I have no way of really knowing this, and I would love to somehow find out for sure, but we think that may be the instrument that premiered Bartok Concerto for Orchestra in 1944.
In Symphony Hall. Right.
So, and there's a huge piccolo solo in that piece. So I like to think that this may be the instrument that did that. When my teacher was playing in Cleveland. He was a student of Jimmy Papasakis, who was the second flutist in the Boston Symphony. And then my teacher won a job out of the Army. He played in the Army band during the war, and he went to Cleveland. And Jimmy knew that George Mattson was retiring in 65 and was going to be selling that piccolo. So he called Bill Hebert and said, "You need to ask about this piccolo." And he did that, and Bill bought this piccolo. And so Bill, all the great recordings you hear of Zell, all those Beethoven symphonies and Kiji and Shostakovich 5 and, you know, Tchaikovsky 4 with Laura Mazel, all of those recordings for the Cleveland Orchestra were done with this piccolo that was my teacher had bought. And so he retired. It went to the second flutist of the Cleveland Orchestra, Martha Ahrens, who was his student. And Martha called me about 4 years ago and said, "I'm not playing it. It needs to be played. Do you want it?" And I said, "Yes, I want it." And
there's a movie here, you know, the red violin, the silver piccolo.
I know.
Starring
or
Cynthia
the
Myers,
piccolo,
So, and we flash back. Oh, I can see this movie. Just
so it came back to Boston 4 years ago, I guess now, and I've been playing it, not as my only piccolo. I play another instrument as well, the instrument I've been playing for many years. But a lot of the high, loud. In the Shostakovich 10, the last movement, second movement, last movement are all on that piccolo.
Because your repertoire is real varied. I mean, let's even the pops. I mean, everybody knows everybody when Stars and Stripes Forever happens.
I've got a great story about that.
You got a great story about that.
I do.
And, you know, more gags about piccolo players.
I know.
When you leave, you're the first one off the stage.
Yep.
All these other people lugging basses, drummers, percussionists.
But we also can go into an elevator with a bass player and look at them and say, "Don't you wish you played the piccolo?"
Yeah, it's another one. I think that's a New Yorker one.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
No, but Stars and Stripes, one of my very last concerts with the Houston Symphony in 2006 was July 4th. And I turned to my second flutist and I said, "Wow, this is the last time I'm ever going to have to play Stars and Stripes." Because, of course, the Boston Symphony's out at Tanglewood during that time, and it's the Boston Pops Esplanade Orchestra who plays July 4th. So I'm not going to have to do that anymore. And my colleague said, "Wow, that must be a really good feeling." And I said, "Yeah, kind of. I'm kind of tired of this." I obviously did not do my research. And the end of my first pop season, I called my colleague in Houston and I said, "Judy, I've played Stars and Stripes 38 times. So I learned my lesson. And Stars and Stripes really well. So...
You have had just a wonderful career. Now you're teaching privately.
I also teach at NEC.
At NEC.
Yeah.
In addition to the full schedule with the Boston Symphony, the tours. Just had this very successful European tour. There are other tours coming up.
There are. I think our next one, we do a small North American tour to New York, Montreal, and Toronto in the spring. And then we have Japan, I believe, coming up.
How do you adjust to different halls? Because your instrument has such a... sound to it. It cuts
it's
through
hard.
Anything.
It's hard. It takes time, and to a certain extent, you just kind of have to rely on the fact that you have to play what you know your instrument does and not worry too much about the acoustics that you're in, because it'll throw you off. So certain halls I adjust to really quickly.
Can you adjust at rehearsal when you know?
If you have the time. Yeah. Normally our sound checks, if we don't have a complete, you know, a rehearsal in the hall, we can run to a hall and be there with a half an hour sound check or a 15-minute sound check. So you can check the louds and you can check the softs. But on my part, sometimes he won't even hit something I play because I rest for large quantities of time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I spend a lot of time warming up on the stage. I'll spend time with other people on the stage because people drastically change how a hall sounds. We noticed that out here at Tanglewood. Last night when we did the Verdi Aida, I was commenting at break. It's like, wow, it feels really dead in here because it was humid and it was a packed house. And so it changes the acoustic drastically. So, you know, even in our home halls, conditions can change where you have to adjust rapidly, and you get used to that over time. And most of the halls that we play in, there's only one time I can think of where we just never really adjusted and we didn't worry about it. And that was outside in Grafenegg in Vienna. It was 99 degrees and we were doing Mahler 6. And it was such a horrible acoustic, but such a wonderful presence with the audience. And it was so much fun to be there, but the acoustic was awful. And there was just nothing you could do about it. And you just say, you know, we're going to play our best and, you know.
Have you had any works commissioned for you?
One in Houston, actually. We had the contrabassoonist and I had a work for a concerto for contrabassoon and piccolo. And we premiered it on April 1st, which I thought was appropriate. So that was premiered. That was written by Damian Montano. So I'm trying to talk Greg Henniker into doing that with me at some point in time. I think it'd be fun on Pops, you know, at least. It would be a good show.
Well, you've had a wonderful career, and there seems to be no end to it. As you head into how many years now?
I'm starting my 11th season with the BSO. I came here in 2006.
And played under some, not only our present music director, but some great guest conductors,
oh,
too.
Oh, my gosh.
Do you have
any
favorites?
Dutoit is way up there for me. I love playing for Dutoit. I love playing for Haitink. He's somebody I'm actually in awe of. That was a pinch-myself moment the first time I played for him, because I grew up with those recordings. I grew up with Doc Gnani in Cleveland. He was their music director. So I heard everything they did, sometimes three times a week. We would beg, borrow, and steal to get into symphony, you know, to Severance Hall to hear them.
It's interesting you mentioned these great musicians, because of that era before that. Harry Ellis Dixon once told me, he said, you know, under some of these titans, we played mostly under fear.
Yeah.
Bill said that conductors.
About Zell.
Yeah, Zell, Fritz Reiner, Toscanini.
Oh, you know.
I mean, they got results, but in a very nasty way.
Yeah, I mean, the old guys in Cleveland would talk about Reiner, and they'd say, you know, well, you know, when he died, six guys volunteered from the Cleveland Orchestra to be pallbearers.
Yeah.
And I made the comment. I said, oh my gosh, you must have had such respect. They said, oh no, we wanted to put him in the ground, make sure he stayed there. I mean, they were scared to death of him.
Thankfully, that era is long gone.
Yeah, much longer gone.
It'd be terrible pressure for musicians to play and play.
Zell was that way. But my teacher loved him, and he loved my teacher, Bill Hebert. He adored Bill. And he got a certain sound out of the orchestra that still, even this many years, it's still very much present.
It's interesting how different conductors in Ozawa, Munch, Leinsdorf, Levine, and now Andrus develop their own sounds. But it takes time, doesn't it?
Right.
But you hear the sound, particularly now in Shostakovich,
right,
that's coming into fruition.
Right. Oh, I think it's
you just
very
know
much
it's the,
changing.
You just know it's the Boston Symphony playing Shostakovich.
Yeah. Yeah, which is interesting, because I don't think that the orchestra was ever known as Shostakovich Orchestra. I mean, it's always more of a French, you know, French sound. But he's bringing things out in the orchestra that are new, and I think exciting. And, you know, the orchestra is excited to do it. It's great repertoire. I mean, it's the best repertoire out there. So it's very exciting.